Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I ask you to hold your calls for the time being because we have with us this evening Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin, when we first became acquainted some years ago, was professor at, I believe, at USC. He's a retrovirologist. He certainly has both a PhD and an MD. He ran the laboratory at one of the largest county hospitals in the entire country. That was Los Angeles County Hospital. And of course, through the years, we've talked many times about what we're going to be talking about this evening, but I think it's something to keep in front of the people of America. And that is the fact that we have a real serious problem. It's been created, not perhaps intentionally at all, but it was created as a direct result of the original polio vaccine. The original polio vaccine was grown in a kidney of the culture of the rhesus monkeys. And, of course, they rushed this to the market without ever bothering to check and see what other viruses were in the vaccine they were giving to the American people. Well, there were a whole flock of monkey viruses there, and the 40th one was something known as SP40, which was a cancer virus. Well, when they found that, they couldn't tell the American people the truth. Now, everything I'm telling you is in a book put out by the NIH called The Health Century. It's written by Edward Shorter. That's The Health Century, written by Edward Shorter. It's all in my articles. You can get them on my web. I think in a year 2002, June and July, had all the references for everything we're telling you. So, you know, we can't tell the American people that. We can't pull this off the market. We've got to do something. What do we do? Let's switch monkeys. Let's go to the green monkey. Because, of course, they don't have SP40. So I'm going to let Dr. Martin pick up the story from there. Is that a pretty good summary of where we got, how we got into where we are?
That was a very good summary, and I appreciate your giving that historical background, but the issue now is, at present, our nation is facing an epidemic of varying illnesses, differently categorized the way they present to clinicians, children. It can be autism, these attention deficit learning disorder, behavioral disorders. Adults, it's more likely the depression, chronic fatigue syndromes, and so forth. And to realize that we have an epidemic, and for our system not to want to link an epidemic to an infectious process is where the big disappointment. That's the part that has to be changed. And as you said, what feeds into that consideration is the fact that our public health authorities do know that many of the vaccines used in the past did have contaminating viruses, and information on this came out even as recently as the end of last year in the United States Food and Drug Administration, and even more recently earlier this year in the English comparable organization, that virtually at least half of the batches of polio vaccines used back in the 1970s had a cytomegalovirus contamination.
All right, fine. So basically what we're talking about is the American public has been contaminated with cytomegalovirus viruses that came from the polio vaccine, not the initial one. We got a lot of monkey viruses in that, about 40 of them at least we know of. But then, of course, when they switched to the green monkey, why we got these cytomegalovirus viruses that came from the green monkey. And, of course, these can produce a chronic form of illness. So let's pick up the story from there. How does this, you say this, attacks the central nervous system? But with most diseases, of course, people get infected and they have an acute episode. They get over the disease and that's the end of it. Either that or it kills them. But, of course, it doesn't kill very many people. So what is the thing, how should we look upon where we are today? Because this is unique and different than other diseases, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Stan. And to go back just historically for that moment, In 1972, a formal study was conducted with the Food and Drug Administration and the manufacturer of polio vaccines. 11 monkeys were set aside to test for any possible contaminant. All of the monkeys grew out this cytomegalovirus, but that information was never made public, partly to protect proprietary interests, and partly because looking across the board, there was a feeling, gee, this vaccine is not causing any problems, and viruses would cause an acute disease, like influenza, SARS, smallpox even. It wasn't realized then that viruses can cause this long, persisting type illness. It really took the occurrence of HIV to pinpoint viruses as a cause of chronic, persistent illnesses. Now we're facing the situation that some of those viruses overlooked back in the 1970s can be identified in patients now who have these chronic fatiguing type illnesses and other more severe neurological diseases.
Now, could this play a part in at least some of the cases of MS and anterolateral sclerosis, what we refer to as Lou Gehrig's disease?
Oh, absolutely, no question that the underlying pathology can be a combination of a viral component, and then in different patients, complicated by an autoimmune process, perhaps on the wrong genetic background, aggravated also by environmental toxins. But the one element to focus on to prevent this epidemic and cope with it is the communicable component, the infectious component, what we call stealth-adapted viruses.
Well, of course, now this goes back to the 1950s. We started giving the Salk vaccine in 55. We started giving the Sabin vaccine in 61 or 62, somewhere in there. Now this, of course, is 40 years ago. What is the incidence of these viral infections in people today, and can this be transmitted from mothers to their children when they bear them?
Yeah, the answer to the first question is, I think, basically, it's almost public knowledge now that there's increasing incidences of these chronic debilitating diseases, many involving the brain. But to go back to our own CDC, Centers for Disease Control, in a recent publication, it was noted over the last 10 years, an average of over 19,000 hospitalizations are occurring with a severe diagnosis called encephalitis, basically a brain-damaging illness. This is a large number. What's interesting is when subsets of these patients have been pulled aside for very detailed studies. In California here, the health department has analyzed over 100 of these patients each year for the last several years. In the majority, they are still befuddled. They don't know what's causing these illnesses. And my sense of it from talking with them is, again, this reluctance to look at the obvious source, which is an infectious component.
Well, certainly there's the there's the West Nile and encephalitis, but we don't get that in California, at least not yet. But then there's the Western equine encephalitis and St. Louis encephalitis. But I'm assuming that these diseases you're speaking of really don't fit into those categories.
No, absolutely. So there, in some of these cases, these 19,000 or more cases a year, they can identify a cause. But in over 60% of the cases, there's no identifiable cause. What was kind of, I think, inappropriate is to downplay the possibility of an infectious component and try to pin the blame on pesticides or some other toxins. That takes the pressure away from coming up with the urgency of finding something that's contagious.
Now, of course, you have been working on this. This has really been your forte ever since we met. It must be close to 10 years that we've been talking back and forth. And there are actually certain brain biopsies on some of these patients and postmortem examination on some of them because some of them have died. And what do they find in them that is so unique to this type of illness that you would not find in other illnesses?
Mm-hmm. And you're right on target. And it's been a nice association with you over the last 10 years, and in some ways be proud of the progress and yet be embarrassed by how slow the progress has been. from the very first isolate, the thing that was so striking was the failure of the virus to provoke the immune system to give rise to an inflammatory reaction. Most pathologists look for inflammation as the hallmark of an infection. And if they don't see inflammation, they basically don't consider an infectious origin. Now, we know with these viruses, and particularly the ones that came from the monkeys and therefore presumably from the polio vaccines, that they do not have the component that our immune system targets for its immune defense. And again, it's not widely appreciated even among virologists that even though a virus might have 100 different components, the immune system only selects 2 or 3 components to provide the effective targets. And if a virus deletes out those 2 or 3 components, it becomes what we call stealth-adapted. And then this virus can basically evade, bypass the whole immune process. It can cause damage in the brain particularly, but it won't be recognized and there won't be this inflammatory reaction.
But there is a reaction, of course, that you do see on the microscope, don't you, if you know what to look for?
Oh, absolutely. And again, we know we've learned this because we've taken these viruses and put them into animals and university environments, and friendly, frisky, happy-go-lucky animals transform very quickly to reclusive, irritated, irritable animals. Again, their brain histology or pathology of the brain won't show the inflammation, but it does show 3 very interesting changes, the last one of which is very important. The first change, they all become foamy, vacuolated. They have a lot of lipid, cholesterol type of inclusions, and that seemingly reflects the fact that the mitochondria, our energy-generating machinery inside the cells, are damaged.
Now, these you're looking at the cell, and you see that sort of foamy. They're sort of vacuolated. They don't look like normal, healthy cells. You call them foamy cells.
Yeah, they look like foamy cells because they have a lot of lipid, and this is, even the pathologists who do this, not suspecting a virus, will often comment upon the vacuolated change. And it's interesting, a vacuolated change is also a hallmark of scrapie and some of the prion type illnesses. But the fundamental damage is that the mitochondria, this energy-generating organelle that takes oxygen plus food and makes energy for the cell, those mitochondria are severely damaged.
And so then, of course, the patient who has this disease gets this terrible or intense fatigue.
Oh, absolutely. The cells can't function properly. What has been an important finding, and I say it's important in the context of wanting to help these patients, is in addition to those changes, the cells acquire or accumulate material that is organized, and as we've looked into it, it is serving an alternate source of cellular energy. And so we're calling these materials alternate cellular energy pigments. And this is an important finding because it illustrates, again, how fantastic the body is, how it can cope with infections in different ways. But it does provide an approach now to help these patients by augmenting the activity of these, calling them ACE pigments, and that's the kind of study that ought to be done, in an urgent way to try to help these large numbers of patients with these brain deteriorating and brain damaging illnesses.
Now, of course, you commented that there was a young boy that the parents were really so upset because of this encephalitis, and they'd taken him to several universities and they'd actually done brain biopsies. Did those biopsies show these same foamy cells?
Oh, absolutely. But again, it's an educational process. Getting the message out to neuropathologists and to other clinicians that you don't have to have inflammation, yet you can still have an infection. So this particular boy had his first brain biopsy in Las Vegas by a very well-qualified neurosurgeon. The brain biopsy was sent to NIH, sent to Rochester, one of our major centers for neuropathology. The parents, both being physicians, took the child to Johns Hopkins University, Scripps Clinic, to Stanford. The neurosurgeons and neurologists at Stanford having looked at the earlier biopsy material, we're still uncertain what was going on, did another brain biopsy, but again, they're misled, or at least they're not led towards thinking of an infectious process because there's no inflammation.
Now, this boy had an encephalitis, and what eventually happened? Did he ever come out of it, or was it more or less a permanent coma?
First of all, it took about 7 months before the organic nature of this child's illness became apparent. And basically, the family was sick, the parents were undergoing divorce, and this child was, his abnormal behavior was ascribed to his acting out because of the family situation for fully 7 months before he came off a softball game once, said to his mom he could see double, had a rage reaction a couple of days later in the presence of his father, even threatened to knife his older brother. So they knew something was wrong. Even then, when there was an abnormal CAT scan, a neurologist, a very well-qualified neurologist, on straightforward clinical examination, couldn't discern that anything was wrong, yet an MRI at the time was clearly abnormal, and that led to the brain biopsy. So these are difficult situations for even the expert clinicians to deal with, but it does make the point that you can't exclude an encephalopathy just on the basis of saying, well, the clinical exam is normal. Yet this is sort of the situation with so many of our children who are undergoing behavioral problems, conduct disorder, eating disorders. A typical pediatrician or neurologist even will do a clinical exam and say there's nothing wrong, it must be a psychiatric illness, and then ascribe the problem to family dynamics, upbringing, and so forth, and not realize that there's an ongoing process that is contributed to by a viral component.
You know, the thing is that we're taught as physicians to look at specific symptoms, and if you put the symptoms together, you come up with a diagnosis of a disease. But and here's a disease that is not recognized. It's been around for 50 years, probably. But, of course, it's, the problem is that there's been a conscious, organized effort to keep the people from knowing about this, because if the people ever really realize, first of all, what happened with the first polio vaccine, and then, of course, what happened as we switched from the original polio vaccine to the Sabin vaccine, and, of course, that was had certainly the cytomegalic virus in it. Why, if we let people know that, they would begin losing confidence in the scientists. They'd begin losing confidence in vaccines. And so I think the Public Health Service feels, you know, that for the greater good, it's far better not to let this information out. After all, we wouldn't want to frighten the people and have them begin questioning what we're doing, because, you know, we are certainly trying to do good. And so by suppressing the existence of this clinical entity that you're talking about, do you think there's any of that in this? Because certainly there are people back there who know about these cytomegalic viruses in the general population, and said, yet this is not common knowledge among the average doctor, and certainly not among the population as a whole.
So again, Stan, I feel very comfortable sitting at CDC directly opposite the person who knows of the problem, and to ask, why aren't you working on it? And then to get the answer, which I can describe after the break, of essentially not getting the clearance from the leadership.
Not getting the clearance from the leadership. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin certainly has been trying to draw attention to this for many years. He has both MD and his PhD. One of the best trained scientists we have in the United States. He certainly has worked with all of the key and leading scientists. And, of course, goes to meetings regularly at the NIH and CDC. We'll be back here in just a few minutes and, of course, continue this discussion right here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. John Martin. Of course, we're talking about Dr. Martin's effort to try to bring this out. But he was just saying that when he was talking with the people at the CDC and asked them why they wouldn't bring out the discussion of the cytomegalic viruses, infections which are so common in our population, and of course we got them from the viruses, from the vaccines that were grown in the culture of the kidney of the green monkey. That was the second group of viruses, the cytomegalic viruses. And you were saying that the gentleman at the CDC said that he didn't have permission to bring this out?
That's exactly right. Again, I wouldn't be so enthusiastic about now is the time to proceed if I didn't feel comfortable that there is an opportunity of providing directed therapy for these patients. I think the argument, and you expressed it earlier, is that a view of doom and gloom and everybody's made the mistake and so forth is not particularly, is not going to be embraced enthusiastically by our political system. But given that there's insight now as to how the cells are coping with these infections, it's about time that we did identify the infectious component. Also, I truly see each week a family coming in where the illness would have started with one member, but by the time we're now seeing the whole family, everybody is coming down with the illness. And this makes it doubly hard if you're a parent struggling to cope with your own illness and at the same time trying to be a parent to a child with severe learning disorders or conduct disorders in the school system.
And, of course, really, of course, what you're seeing then is it's extending throughout entire families, and this is an infectious element. In fact, this certainly is in the blood supply, isn't it? And the people are taking either blood transfusions or are taking, certainly the blood components like platelets or fibrinogen or white cells transfusions, things of that sort. They could certainly pick this up from blood, couldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. And even community-wide outbreaks, you may recall Dr. Donovan Anderson at Needles, California, identified an outbreak in 1996.
Are you speaking now of chronic fatigue? Or?
Yeah, and again, Stan, some people can be labeled chronic fatigue, others depression, others if they're elderly, well, they just have Alzheimer's disease. Children with their learning disorders, but there have been other outbreaks that have come up, reported to the CDC, and it's almost, well, we're not interested, we don't want to evaluate it, we don't want to investigate it. Jolton, Tennessee is an outbreak. There's a lady now in Urbana, I think it is, in Illinois. But there's, once one takes off the blinders, as it were, and looks at what's going on, it's so obvious that one needs to consider an infectious component to these illnesses.
Well, you know, one of the most fascinating books I ever read was something called Osler's Web by Hilary Johnson. Are you acquainted with that book?
Yes, and I knew her well.
Do you think that there's some truth to what she said?
Oh, there's no doubt that the political process is, to put the right spin on it, which sort of basically says, let's not be frankly, approach these things just for the sake of it. And
well, we're going to have to interrupt you here because we're going to have to bring our listeners back from the Great Northwest right up there in Spokane and in Fires. We'll be right back in just a moment with them. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. John Martin, and we're talking about, of course, these outbreaks of chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or all of these, and they come in clusters. And, of course, the government has done everything they can to cover this up. Now, one of the most fascinating books is Osler's Web. We still have a few copies of this. This book has been, it's almost impossible to get, but somebody got a whole flock of them for us, and so we've been offering it. It's an inexpensive book. It's called Osler's Web. I promise it is one of the most fascinating books you'll ever read, because it's a story of the first outbreak of chronic fatigue syndrome at Incline Village and the organized effort on the part of the Centers for Disease Control not to admit that it was real or to try to put this into a psychiatric category. And then, of course, when treatments came up for some of these things to prevent them from being accepted. And we're talking about somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people who just have chronic fatigue syndrome, independent of the fibromyalgia, independent of all the autism and behavioral problems. And these are real problems out there. And, of course, if we continue to look to government to solve the problem, at least unless we can change the attitude of the people in, within the legislature, nothing is going to change. Certainly, as they point out in the book, Osler's Web, why the people organized. Here you got a block of 800,000 ill Americans. They're totally incapacitated. So they get Congress to appropriate money for research for chronic fatigue, and what happens? Why, of course, the CDC refuses to spend it. They spend it for something else. Nobody's ever punished. They spend it on psychiatric evaluations and tests and anything to avoid facing the reality of what's going on. And so, Dr. Martin, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about your hope. What you're trying to do is to get the people organized to put together an organization which really can have an impact on bringing this to the public, because if the public isn't concerned, if they're not concerned about their health and the health of their families, we're certainly not going to get any help at all from the people of the CDC or political, and of course their objective is to get through without losing their job. So why don't you pick up, what are you trying to accomplish?
Thank you for this opportunity. Now, I'm a believer in the system, but I know that the system in Washington operates by what influences the politicians. And it's very clear that pharmaceutical lobbyists have money, but that money is primarily converted into votes. If one had the appropriate grassroots movement, people basically expecting our public health service to address the real problems that we're facing, then changes would occur. And a nice series of coincidences and absolutely remarkable situation starting, I guess I'll go back for a moment, with the father of a schizophrenic son. The son developed schizophrenia at the age 18, and the father said, I'm not going to institutionalize you. And that's 30 years ago. So he has lived at home for 30 years, the father doing everything he can, but now getting on in life, was somewhat anxious as to what was going to happen, met with me and said, at least we have this Mental Illness Hope Foundation, MI Hope. Could you take it and put some use to it? I was very grateful to receive that as a gift, not to me, just a non-profit foundation, but a gift for the cause of trying to pursue this research effort. Spoke to the IRS officer, talked to him as I'm talking to your audience, about viruses and schizophrenia. The IRS officer came out straightforwardly and said, but I thought schizophrenia was a chemical imbalance. Yes, for sure, I said, but what's causing it? Don't you see how viruses could be the cause of a chemical imbalance in the psychiatric illnesses? He immediately picked up on that and then said, look, what you have is a private 501(c), make it a public one, get out there and get members. And almost with that gift from him, have been instructed and have followed his advice, changed the name from MI, Mental Illness Hope, because it's a bigger problem, and wanted to have a scientific, social, and spiritual support. I'm more the scientist, but I've come across people who recognize that these patients afflicted with these illnesses, and particularly the children, have an entitlement to social support to help them cope with these illnesses, and somehow just the overall coincidences of good things happening adds a spiritual component to it. So with that in mind, we've established a S3 support program, a website of that name, s3support.com, and it's available for members to come in as a way of communicating more privately, as it were, to groups and not being criticized for spreading too much stuff outside, but information about vaccine programs and hopefully information on treatment protocols that can help people, and then in fact people can participate.
All right, fine. We're going to have to interrupt you right here. We'll be back in just a moment after the break. Our guest is Dr. John Martin, and of course when we get back, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I guess this evening is Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin is talking about this group he's trying to get together to build grassroots support, to get the funding, and of course, even more than that, to make people aware, of course, of what is going on, to build a force that will begin to demand that something be done and this be addressed. And the people in the CDC who don't want to talk about it because, after all, we wouldn't want to, of course, rock the boat. Of course, S3 Support is the website. That's S3 Support. Is that .com?
.com. We have it as .org, but .com, since most people are more familiar with .com rather than .org. But it's a tax-deductible 501(c) organization. And it's evolving, but it certainly now is available for members. And I'm looking forward to people participating in this grassroots effort.
And, of course, the thing is, of course, that there's so much research that needs to be done. And then, of course, Dr. Martin, it talks about the treatment protocols. Now, of course, what you're talking about is sort of harnessing the normal reparative process within the human body that, of course, can begin to get the immune system working and beginning to handle this, because there really are no magic pills for these viruses, but certainly, ordinarily, you know, a healthy body could deal with these. It probably has in many people, and then something comes along, an insult, an injury, an illness or something, and then they decompensate, and of course no longer are they able to fight off these viruses, which has already been there, and they begin to overwhelm the system. So would you like to just pick up there, what can be done for these people? Because I know you've been fascinated in working on these treatment protocols.
Absolutely. And that's why, again, we're interested in having patients recruited into the clinical trials. So the major development in the last year or so has been the identification of these alternate cellular energy pigments. So most of the protocols that are now being evaluated, some in animals, and I'm hoping to get it more into IRB-approved clinical trials, is recognizing this alternate cellular energy component, how it can be supported both in terms of the components as well as the activation using biophysics approach. What has been fascinating to me is once we came onto that, how I could look back on the work of Edgar Cayce, probably starting it off, the Royal Raymond Rife, various people and various products out there that are growing in use, even green vegetables, carotenoids, I think you had the Miracle 2 product. Once we put these ACE pigments into the equation and realize that they can provide energy for the cells, once they're released from the cell, they tend to be damaging, causing coagulation problems. But it provides a very solid foundation to design good clinical trials, and I think there's an urgency to get these trials underway. And for that, we certainly need participants and certainly appreciate what support we can.
Well, now, tell us about these pigments. I've heard you mention them, and I'm not sure exactly what they are.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. So, again, in the sense of even the first patient, Stan, that we had a brain biopsy done back in 1990 as a school teacher from Palm Springs, the definite change, very severe deterioration. But there was material in the cell that literally for about 10 years I was dismissing as cellular debris, lipofusion, irrelevant pigment. And only in the last couple of years did I begin to re-look at material and see how beautifully structured it was when we got down at the level of an electron microscope, and then began to see similar material in the cultures and realized that it was able to capture energy, whether it was light, electromagnetic, sound, and convert that physical energy into cellular energy, and basically was functioning as an alternative to the mitochondria in the cells.
Well, Well, you know, we've heard for years that of course sound, music, things like that can have an effect on plants, and certainly we know sound or music can have a profound impact on the human, and certainly on the human psyche. In fact, it was Aristotle who said, you know, if I could control the music, I could control the society. Are you suggesting that sound or in any way music could influence these pigments that you're talking about that could then energize the cells?
Absolutely, and the studies are so beautiful to do it, to have these pigments in front of a sound-generating computer and dial up the frequencies and see at certain frequencies they'll resonate, harmonize with the sound, and become activated. Again, I think that there's been a number of pioneering investigators from Dr. Reif. I mean, mentioned Edgar Cayce, some of his observations with animated ash, other people with magnets and so-called scalar waves and so forth. There's observations out there that tended to be discarded by mainstream because it wasn't a very clear explanation. We now can bring some of these observations back into focus and say, gee, they do have relevance to this model of these ace pigments.
No, of course, we know that there are all sorts of people now. They're sleeping on magnet beds and walking on magnets in their shoes, and of course, have the magnets on their back to do away with the back pain. And, of course, I've stayed away from it because most of them are multi-level marketing, and I just want to avoid that as such. But I know that some people really feel that this is very, very beneficial. In other words, what you're doing is changing the electronic aura or the electronic charge that surrounds the human body. Is that...
Oh, absolutely. And I've given talks now, and it's on this website, on kind of biophysics. The last one I gave was photons and phonons, theoretical basis of biophysics and theoretical implications and ramifications. Now, I think, again, that we have the blueprint now to bring some of this pretty exciting observations up to a level of scientific validation. I'm always impressed by the clinicians saying, well, of course they know of a cancer patient whose cancer went away totally unexpectedly from taking some alternate medical approach, whether it was energies or better nutrition and so forth, but they're not willing to go public with it. They feel that they'll be ridiculed or criticized by insurance companies, medical boards, and so forth. And this would be a tragedy if we were overlooking some of the potential therapies that ought not be expensive, ought to be straightforward, that could truly act as the first line of treatment, and then only after that go with the more toxic chemotherapeutic approaches and so forth.
Well, now, Chris, is there any place for antioxidants in the treatment of these people with these chronic fatigue syndromes or these chronic infections? Do antioxidants, glutathione, or any of these other things that people keep talking about, do they play any part in the treatment of these chronic infections?
Oh, absolutely. And I bring it in, and I refer to it more as electron donating power, electron power, but we can certainly begin to evaluate all of these approaches. And as I said, we've come across individual patients who have managed to control their own cancers over a 10-year period using such approaches. And it really makes sense to get the best value out of the food we're taking, nutritional approaches. There was a whole epidemic of encephalitis in Cuba in 1992 attributed to viruses. They could grow the viruses, but it was treated primarily by enhancing the nutritional intake of the patient.
No, was this a virus very similar to what you're talking about, a different type of virus?
No, I think it was one of these stealth-adapted viruses that was in Cuba, and it was with the embargo of additional foods that impacted on vitamins, that there was a vitamin deficiency that aggravated the viral component. There's an interrelationship between the immune system, nutritional support, the energy medicine, and one needs to address all of them. But of the components, the viral component, the infectious component, is the one to really target, because getting a handle on that can help stop the spread of these infections and not putting people at risk of stresses and other deteriorating or influences causing these very severe clinical deteriorations.
All right, well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have any question or comment, I realize that some of this may be a little complicated, because I'm practiced medicine for many years, and certainly Dr. Martin is a physician as well as having his PhD. But, of course, we're trying to bring this down to the point that there is these infections out there that are not commonly recognized. They are these monkey cytomegalic virus infections dating back to the early 1950s. And, of course, people have to recognize that these can be treated. But the difficulty is when you go to the doctor, the average doctor is doing everything he can for you. I've been part of the medical profession for many years. I never knew a doctor that, or maybe more than one or two, that really wasn't totally dedicated to doing everything they could to help. The trouble is that, if you never hear about these things, why, you have no idea that these things are available. In fact, I've learned so much since I left the active practice of medicine and began to study some of these other issues. In fact, at one time I used to do acupuncture, and I got very good at it. Of course, I enjoyed doing orthopedic surgery. But when I could actually begin to sense the aura around the human body with the various tricks I learned and traveled to Europe and Canada and went to meetings in France and in Germany. At that point, I figured maybe I better just go back to doing orthopedic surgery because there were things I didn't understand. And yet, of course, there are elements, charges, there are these things that are out there that really need to be explored by scientists, not by orthopedists who are simply following and rote what they've been taught to do. Well, if you have any question or comment for our guest this evening, Dr. John Martin, our telephone number is, of course, 1-800-544-8927. That's, of course, you'll call if you want to get in touch with me. If you want to talk to Dr. Martin, call 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, you were talking about your website, and that's s3support.com.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a 3 written out? Or
yeah,
is
no, the number 3.
S3 support.
Number3support.com.
Now, are there articles up there? Will people be able to go to that website and actually read some of the articles? Because I know you published rather extensively on these foamyviruses in the past.
Oh, absolutely. And again, we're trying to have it as this membership organization, but all of the publications are there, including two that came out June of this year dealing with these ACE pigments, as well as the one demonstrating the existence of these pigments inside brain biopsies. So the lecture on biophysics. And I'm hoping it will be a two-way street. I mean, there are so many people out there who are afflicted. One number that really shook me was the applications to the court by parents needing to have the children taken away from them legally so they'd be no longer responsible for the medical costs of care.
No, they just couldn't afford to keep it up with the custodial care that was required.
Yeah, and they were being threatened with their own bankruptcies and so forth. So they had to get court permission to basically disown and make the child, their own child, a ward of the state. This occurred, believe it or not, in over 12,700 times in the year 2001 in a mere sampling of 19 mid-sized states.
All right.
Not even across the whole country. And I just can't conceive of a parent having to look his son or daughter in the eye and saying, "I'm sorry, I can't look after you." I mean, husband and wives do that often enough, in spite of their vowing. But I'm more impressed like this man saying to his son with schizophrenia, "I'm not going to institutionalize you. I'm going to stick with you and do what I can for you." And the idea of being forced because a child is going through this type of behavioral conflict and conduct disorders and so forth, of saying, "You're on your own. I'm no longer responsible for you. I basically disown you. You're too much of an expense." So I think there's enormous social price out there that is not aired, as you said, because people are uncomfortable dealing with a topic that they're neither very familiar with, nor do they think there is an answer.
But of course, when you go to doctor and you don't find an answer, not because the doctor doesn't care, because he just doesn't know. Let's go to Scott calling here from Spokane. Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you,
Doctor? I'm doing fine. A question or comment?
Oh, I just had a question about the chronic fatigue that you were talking about.
Right.
Is there any treatment for that, or even genetic depression?
Well, all right, we'll get Dr. answer that.
I'm very happy to answer it, Scott. I think the major message for the first part of this talk tonight is, with all these diseases, not to focus on the label, because somebody can be labeled chronic fatigue by one doctor, depression by another, somebody else, but to recognize that within that grouping, a lot of the individuals can have a viral infection. It can be a viral component. In the last paper we published, I detailed very much the procedures that are appropriate to culture for these viruses, and one ought to be able to go to the public health laboratory and say, I might be infected with one of these viruses, and it may have in fact came from a polio vaccine at one stage. I want to be tested to see if I am infected, and then if I'm infected, let's start working on ways that might help get the infection out of me. In the interim, there is a lot to be said for supporting the mitochondria function, energy approaches, but again, to make progress in that field is going to require the clinical studies. But the clinical studies will come once the cause of the illnesses are identified, and in particular, the contribution being made by these stealth viruses.
So basically, we have a 4-tape set on chronic fatigue, and you'll actually hear in that some of the remarks that Dr. Martin is making. Or you can get copies of this program this evening, but there are lots of things that can be done even now to try to build up our response. And of course, there's lots more that has to be done. In fact, there have been people out there working on these things for many years, but and of course, Dr. Martin was mentioning a man named Royal Rife. He was around 50 years ago and talking about these vibrations, and that there were specific, many diseases would respond to certain vibration treatment. There were certain viruses that, how did the Rife treatment work? Did it actually attack certain viruses with certain vibration? How did that work?
Yeah, the bottom line was that he could see from tumor cells and other tissues and microorganisms a fluorescence that developed when he put energy in at certain wavelengths. And he had a very powerful microscope to look at that. And then if he gave enough energy at a particular resonance frequency, then he could disrupt the virus and it would destroy virus and or bacteria. What I've noted in these cultures is that if we expose the cultures to similar types of energies, if we do it at a low regulated level, the cultures improve considerably. If we go beyond that threshold level, then we can destroy the virally infected cells. So I'm quite comfortable, again, that people like Dr. Rife had very solid observations. The frustration for him was that it didn't fit into mainstream medicine at the time, and he didn't have the information that is now available. He certainly knew a lot for the time when he was a phenomenally insightful investigator, but he didn't know what is now known with regards physics, these ACE pigments, and so forth. So there is potential of using energies, including ultrasound, magnetic, electromagnetic, to assist individuals who have these ACE pigments.
I think, Scott, that there's no hard and fast treatment, but there's a lot more, we know a lot more now, and certainly Dr. Martin is on the front lines of this. I know he's traveled all over the world giving talks on this, and he's looked upon as a world authority in the treatment of this chronic fatigue, and we use that term loosely because it's sort of a catch-all phrase, but the people who have this chronic, fatigue type of syndrome. Of course, probably many of them are related to these chronic infections. So does that answer your question? Let me suggest you go to his website, or if you have any question, you can call me off the air. You can reach me at 800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But go to Dr. Martin's website at S3, that's the letter 3, support.com, and get his information, okay?
Well, if it's not viral, could it be, are there any treatments for genetic, you know, handed down from generation to generation?
Well, how would you respond to that?
I just want to put it, Scott, think of all of these components as being additive. In other words, a genetic background then can set you up for a particular response to the virus when it occurs, added to by an autoimmune component, and even made worse by a environmental factors. I don't think it's so much that it's one or the other. The majority of patients we've had a chance to examine, it's been much more a combination of factors. And when we do see it passing through families, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the genes, as it could also be that one member of the family is infected and that infection can spread, as infections do, from one person to another.
In fact, you remember years ago, I remember when I was in medical school, they used to talk about leukemia and how leukemia would occur in families. And, you know, at the time it was, why would they all be in the same families? Could it be that there's an infectious basis for that? Well, of course, now we know that, well, there really are these viruses out there that do produce many of the severe neoplasms that affect both animals and human beings. Okay, Scott, anything else you'd like to ask?
No, thank you very much.
Bless, thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Steve calling. Hi, Steve, where are you calling from?
Royal Oak, Michigan.
Okay, well, it's good to have you with us. And do you have a question or comment?
Just a comment. First of all, the pleasure's all mine. I listen and thank God for y'all and your ministry.
And you listen on a regular basis back there in Royal Oaks?
Yes, sir, all the time on the Internet.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I actually went and built one of those Rife electromagnetic devices for myself, and it found it very beneficial.
And actually, I think you can actually, I know a gentleman, a friend of mine, bought one, and he uses it, and he says a lot of the people who benefit from it, but this is not accepted, you know, by general medicine at all.
No, it's scoffed at, but there are some devices that the FDA has approved, like the diabetic wound healing devices and the magnetic bone healing stimulators.
Right, I know. I used to use those, and in fact, we even implanted them in the back to stimulate healing.
Yes.
You know, for fusion. So there's a lot here, you know, and we're just really on the very, very on the edge of getting more information.
Yes, it's really has incredible potential. I've done everything with the nutrition. I've been listening and doing everything that many of your guests have recommended, and I just ran into a brick wall, and then I started trying this stuff and found real beneficial effects.
All right, fine. How'd you learn how to make one of those, Steve?
Oh, I'm an electronic engineer.
Okay, fine.
And, you know, cruise the Internet.
All right, fine. Well, I'll tell you what, the information's all there. You know, it's hiding in plain sight. God bless you. Thanks so much for calling.
You too, sir. Bless
Bye-bye.
You all.
Bye-bye. Oh, okay. Well, it's sort of good to know that people are out there listening all across America. Now, if you have a question or comment, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We've only got a few minutes before we have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest. But, of course, we'll be having Dr. Martin with us for another hour. And as we try to, of course, look into these tragic people, and, of course, our last caller, obviously a very capable individual, an electronic engineer, but this is an equal opportunity disease, and it strikes people at all levels of life and all socioeconomic levels. But the tragedy is that so many people, you know, they get to the point they can't work at all, and these are not. And because so many of these people already began having some mental problems as well, they just can't think and think clearly.
Oh, I mean, the brain deterioration is just truly devastating for the whole family structure, and particularly when there's misunderstanding by the spouses, family members, enormous tragedies that are accompanying these, and it's not only the patients, it can also be the animals in the family, and a child particularly sick is bonded to a dog or a cat, and then the dog or cat gets sick, and the veterinarians don't know how to do any better than the clinicians dealing with the child. And this whole sense of a silent epidemic and nobody being willing to speak up and say, let's go after the infectious component, that's where the that's basically the frontier, and that's the message to get out tonight, to say, if you have an epidemic, as people readily admit now with autism, some of these learning disorders, chronic fatigue, and so forth, do what's right and consider the infectious component, particularly knowing that vaccines were contaminated with these viruses, knowing that some of these viruses were isolated from patients. Get on the stick, start looking for these stealth-adapted viruses in these patients, and recognize the illness as having an infectious component so that treatment can be more readily and more rapidly developed.
And for the skeptic out there, let me once again suggest the book by Hillary Johnson. It's called Oster's Web. I think we still have a few copies of that. And, you know, it's written like a detective mystery. I won't tell you how it ends, but I will tell you it's one of those books that I read every single word of. It's not a book you can skim. And right up to the very end, she holds you in suspense. And whatever happened to Hillary? You know, she did such a magnificent job in writing this story and talking to people all across the country involved in this tragic situation. And then, of course, frustrated at every turn by government officials who refused to recognize what was going on and actually designed experiments, which I think were predetermined to fail.
And I don't really want to comment, but I think, again, the story needs to be rewritten and rewritten over and over again in terms of when it finally is recognized that there were a downside to some of the vaccine clearing mechanisms and how long it's taken to confront them. Not to say that vaccines are bad, but certainly to say that when problems do arise, the public is entitled to hear about them and ought to be part and parcel of the decisions as to what should be done to remedy problems when they were clearly identified.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And, of course, this is the time when I want to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you listen to us on a regular basis and you believe there's a problem and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family and help us, and I know everybody can't do it, but if you're in a position to do it, why, of course, we would love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, you do that simply by calling 1-800-5-448-927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And as you know, I'm on the air 5 hours a day. And of course, all of our programs are up there on the internet live. We archive our Radio Liberty programs or our MP3, a disc of both my American Freedom and my Genesis programs. And you want to know how to get those, why we can get that information to you. But if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters and my June newsletter goes into why we have so many new diseases, why we have so many antibiotic-resistant diseases, why, of course, we have such an increase in cancer in recent years. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'd be glad to, of course, send you a free copy of our newsletter. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, I very much fear for the future of this nation. And lastly, we ask you, of course, to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so we'll be back here in just a few minutes with our special guest for the second hour. And to our listeners in the Great Northwest, I bid you good night, and we'll be with you again tomorrow night. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're here on the Central Coast of California. Now, our guest this evening is Dr. John Martin, who, of course, has his MD and his PhD, and he's been working in retrovirology and virology for many, many years. In fact, he was with the FDA back in the,
from about 1975 to 1980, in the division that was looking at the possibility of cancer-causing agents in vaccines.
And of course, you actually found some DNA, didn't you, when you were there? And you were very concerned. This was in the polio vaccine, and you reported that. What was that story about?
Yeah, good memory. Around 1977, there was concern because by electron microscopy, there was a suggestion of a retrovirus in some batches of polio vaccines. There was a little bit of reverse transcriptase activity. So it came to the attention of people and thought that we should at least look at the RNA, but we couldn't do that easily. There was so much DNA in the vaccine, which surprised me. I, like everybody else, had thought that vaccines were really pure viruses and didn't have so much of this cell debris. What was disturbing, though, was when we looked at the DNA, where it came from, most of it certainly came from the monkey cells that were made to produce the vaccine, the normal monkey kidney cells. But there was DNA there that we couldn't identify. It didn't seem to be normal cellular DNA. It seemed to be a concern. I was, as it were, relatively youngster then, and I was baffled and had written about this. The sort of whole attitude of even taking it up to the director of the Bureau of Biologics at the time to be kind of almost scoffed at. Look, John, don't worry about it. Every time you have an apple, you get foreign DNA. But beneath that, pursuing it further, there are all these sort of considerations that shouldn't exist in a public health agency, such as, well, if we don't support the vaccine manufacturers, then we'll be at risk if there is bioterrorism attacks, or that there is economic issues. And what was disappointing to realize after that, that the 1972 study, when they did identify the fact that cytomegaloviruses were growing out of these monkeys, that information certainly could have been provided to me at the time. That was a good clue as to what could have been in that DNA. But the decision was made not to provide that information to me. And the same individual who I spoke to certainly went on to become a vice president of the same pharmaceutical company that was making polio vaccines. And so I've come to realize that a number of people live in that, I won't criticize you, you don't criticize me, I'll look out for your best interest, you look out for mine, in a government system. But it doesn't, it shouldn't exist in our public health. So one of the goals that I had with this S3 support was somehow to try and depoliticize the public health process so that that kind of secondary political considerations wouldn't impact on future public health decisions.
And basically, of course, as I remember this story, by the gentleman that you talked to, you know, said, oh, don't worry about it, John, you get DNA every time you eat an apple. He went then on to become a vice president of the very people he was supposed to be regulating who were making the polio vaccine that you were concerned about. So,
yeah, no, see, I go back and I see these people, but it's like, that's the way it is, John. I mean, another story which I think is relevant to the same situation. I was invited to go along with a group of concerned investigators to discuss Gulf War syndrome in Congress. And so it was an informal meeting with congressional and staff of the senators, and I was all prepared in the afternoon to put in my comments about these viruses. At lunchtime, there was celebration in the cafeteria there of the Congress because these people were promised some funding, some money for low-level chemical exposure. But then to be told, look, John, they've asked that you not be on the program this afternoon. We've taken you from it. They don't want to hear anything about these viruses. Kind of, again, put in perspective for me the fact that there's a limited give in the system, but it's all this compromise. It's not a willingness to be upfront and face the reality. And the reality is that atypical viruses exist. They were hard to detect because they didn't provoke an inflammatory reaction. Difficult to grow, but if you make the effort, you can grow them. And they're now being well enough characterized in terms of sequence data to make their existence unequivocal, as well as proving that some of them came out of vaccines.
Well, of course, the thing is, if by not having you present your paper, before Congress, whoever you're going to present it to, doesn't change the issue at all. They just don't want to address it. We don't want to think about it, out of sight, out of mind. But that isn't going to, of course, to address the people who are incapacitated, who are dying, the people who are, the whole family's life is ruined, if one or several people come down with these terrible, terrible diseases. And we know this is happening. We know from the government's own reports that many of the Gulf War veterans' wives, 40% of them are coming down ill. And so what do you do when you've got an ill husband, you've got an ill wife? Who's going to look after the children? Maybe the children are coming down as well. We're dealing with infectious diseases, and of course, keeping people from talking about it doesn't change the issue at all. It's sort of like sweeping the dirt under the rug. You don't see it, but the dirt is still there. So basically, of course, do you think that these viruses play a part in Gulf War illness, or do you think that there are other factors that perhaps would have triggered this off in certain instances? What are your thoughts specifically on Gulf War illness?
No, I mean, basically, yes to both answers. There's no question in my mind that Gulf War syndrome was a viral illness. And as you said, could be aggravated by other factors, particularly stress and other occurrences of even pesticide exposures. The benefit of doing the cultures was that we could run a culture and we could add some pesticide into it and show how it would make the damage worse. The sad thing, from my point of view, was the telephone call from somebody in the Office of Naval Research saying, John, look at the gamma globulin that our Gulf War vets received. That's where you'll find your stealth viruses, because at the time in early 80s, the procedure for producing gamma globulin did not have a sterilization phase, and that's why hepatitis C came through that process. And this gamma globulin was given as a way of preventing hepatitis A infection amongst people who people deployed and a number of people here on home base to prevent them getting hepatitis A.
Now, they were actually given then a gamma globulin, all the people who went overseas?
Yeah, absolutely, gamma globulin. And again, it was this person saying to me, look there, John, that's where you will find it. She was under a political ceiling, couldn't speak out because she knew if she were to speak out, that was the end of her upward mobility in the government service. She wanted me to look at it. I put an application in specifying as clearly I could, but again, in spite of being reassured that we'll let no stone go unturned, etc., etc., as soon as that issue comes up of a potential infectious component to Gulf War, the doors are shut. And they're shut because the concerns about viability, family members are at risk, and so forth. I hope the difference now, Stan, than before, is that there's a fairly clear path now as to how to treat these illnesses.
that didn't exist before, and perhaps in some ways that helped justify this ignore it, claiming ignorance and so forth. Now I think there's sufficient progress made that this whole issue should be opened up, that people, whether they're being labeled Gulf War Syndrome, Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, ALS, the other sort of severe illnesses, ought to be considered as potentially virally infected.
Well, now, of course, we know that there is an increased incidence of ALS, and for our listeners, that's the Lou Gehrig's disease or anterior lateral sclerosis, but Lou Gehrig's disease is the one we usually know is progressive neurological deficit and eventually, of course, ends up in death. But, you know, we know there's an increased incidence of that in the Gulf War Syndrome. Even the government has admitted that. Were you ever able to get any of the gamma globulin to analyze it when looking for a virus?
No, as I said, absolutely. The doors were slammed shut on that that prospect. But I have been involved with a number of patients with ALS, and again, it's clear that the clinical labeling is somewhat of a compromise. What is being called ALS now differs from the traditional diagnosis. It's broader. Clinicians only have certain categories to put patients, and so they cover a fairly broad range with their syndrome diagnoses, but many of the ALS patients have a prior history of a chronic fatiguing type illness. They have more damage than purely the muscle and the neurons providing impulses to the muscle. So the clinical syndromes can change and drift, and yet the labels tend to stay the same, and the labels incorrectly imply a certain sort of confidence in that diagnosis or predictability, whereas individual patients do cover a very broad spectrum of changes, and discussions among these patients will often give indirect evidence consistent with a viral component. More so, other people in the family who start to show brain-damaging illnesses argue strongly for a viral component.
Well, now, of course, I know that they did not treat a gamma globulin or plasma or simply a factor 8 given to hemophiliacs. They didn't treat that. He treated that before the onset of the AIDS epidemic. But I would think that by 1990, they would have been treating all gamma globulin, he treating it to kill off the viruses. But do you think that they were using an old supply of gamma globulin?
No.
Do we have any way of knowing?
No, again, it's one of these embarrassments for the public health system. I think it was Baxter who came through with a procedural change around 1992, it may have been, in terms of trying to eliminate hepatitis C. And there was a long delay in that process before it finally met with the approval. So that led to, as you may know, a lot of concerns of liability for the hepatitis C outbreak. So there was a procedural improvement, but it wasn't implemented till after the Gulf War Syndrome. And again, to quote this same individual back in government service, if they had it all over again, they would never have used the gamma globulin as a hepatitis A prevention method. But it was done, and I think one of the consequences was in a way of which an illness could have been spread. Probably the biggest issue, as I see it, is that these things can be talked about, but nobody is willing to take it in their hands and say, well, let's go after it and see if this is the cause, even though, as I said, one can find the government officials who will argue so comfortably, we'll let no stone go unturned, et cetera, et cetera. They really, I think, deep down, are unwilling to expose anything that might criticize the decisions made in government public health decisions, and basically are looking at the political ramifications beyond or disregarding the obvious medical ramifications for finding out the cause of these illnesses and then addressing that cause specifically.
Well, of course, you know, the spread of hepatitis C is really one of the most frightening things that, you know, a lot of our prisons, you know, 6-7% of the population has the hepatitis C. It can lead to, of course, cirrhosis of the liver and need for liver transplants. It's estimated 150 million people throughout the world, between 150 million and 200 million people have hepatitis C. Most of them got it from vaccinations using dirty needles. In China alone, 700 million people have hepatitis B. Most of them got it from vaccinations using dirty needles. And then, of course, to think that we could have something like that happen in the United States using a gamma globulin in the name of trying to prevent hepatitis A that they might pick up in the Middle East. And then, of course, using a gamma globulin that wasn't heat treated, that would really be very embarrassing. In fact, there could be real ramifications. Heads would roll. And, of course, nobody wants to have their head roll. And if it does, why, they're going to get whoever released that information. So I can understand why you would have run into a brick wall. But what you're hoping, I'm sure, with this S3 support would be to have a foundation and have the wherewithal to begin to do these scientific studies that need to be done, independent, of course, of the bureaucracy, which is not too anxious to begin looking behind the obvious.
Mm-hmm, that's right. But I'm still the optimist at heart. I believe that once the groundswell occurs and that becomes a bandwagon that people will get on board, then it will bring about changes. There are, and I may as well mention them, other issues just behind this. I mean, the contaminated polio vaccines that, again, proven to be contaminated by recent studies done outside my lab, but the same vaccines used in Africa. And so arguments about, well, did HIV develop from the monkeys used to test these polio vaccines? That's kind of the sorts of issues that people get uncomfortable about. Well, if we grant you this, John, that these stealth viruses exist or that they came out of polio vaccine, where might that lead us next? And then the hint that it might lead to an understanding where HIV came from causes another wave of hesitation and sort of typical bureaucracy type an approach. And I think that the only real leverage to change the system is this public awareness, and to have the public informed that there is something in public opinion, because after all, in the end, that is the determining factor for the political process.
And of course, this is why, ladies and gentlemen, we want you to get informed. And if you'd like to get copies of these tapes for this evening, and you certainly can get them from Radio Liberty, but go to the website, s3support.com, s3support.org, s3support.com, and of course, pull down the information, get the information, help Dr. Martin, because I really think this is a worthy process, and none of us can accomplish what we do without help from others. So this is important, it's well worthwhile doing, and there are people all across America, 800,000 Americans, maybe a million, with what we call chronic fatigue syndrome, a couple of million with fibromyalgia, and then, of course, all of these other associated neurological symptoms, syndromes, totally incapacitating. This is a major public health crisis, and nobody seems to want to talk about it.
And amen, for sure. And the concern obviously extends to the next generation. If we have any responsibility as parents, it's to our children. And to see so many children now being labeled autistic or attention deficit or conduct disorder, oppositional defiant behavior, eating disorders, it's just so prevalent to see this increasing complexities. It's almost hard now to find a parent who has a child that's not involved in one way or another of trying to cope. And to be hearing our public health people talk about the epidemic of autism, the epidemic of obesity, the epidemic of this, and not be willing to do what should come naturally, which is, well, let's look to see if there's an infection. If you have an epidemic, I grew up, epidemic, first thing you exclude is an infectious component. Yet that's where the hesitation is. And nobody
wants to take on the idea of, let's look at these autistic children and see if they're not infected with one of these atypical viruses.
Well, you know, Chris, one of the big problems that we face today is that so much of the scientific research is funded by one, drug companies, of course, and they want to come up with a product that make the money. And number two, by government. And government, of course, does not want anything that's going to rock the boat. So, you know, if you've got something that's going to rock the boat that would suggest that maybe there is some, responsibility on the part of officials for making decisions that were created a disaster, anybody can make a mistake. But what's unconscionable to me is covering up that mistake. And you know what, the book, if you mentioned it during the first hour, but if you can get a copy at your library, it's called The Health Century by Edward Shorter, and Health Century by Edward Shorter. Read that incredible story of the polio vaccine, of what happened to the people who actually found out about the cancer virus in the polio vaccine. Were they awarded? No, they were banished. They were never to speak again. They were forbidden ever to do anything or speak publicly. Why? Because they pointed out there was a cancer virus that was going to infect people all across America in the Sabin vaccine. And I fear that, of course, that has come to pass. And those people who actually did point that out were severely punished. So you can't have a system where, of course, people who do what's right are punished and people who do what's wrong are rewarded. Otherwise, the system really begins to crumble from within. Well, you know, of course, as you're on the front lines of this battle, and I know that you're very often asked to speak at meetings all around the world. I know you've talked all over the world on chronic fatigue, haven't you?
Yes, and more now on these alternate cellular energy pigments. I mean, the next conference, and again, it's a shame to be talking outside the country rather than here, but in Singapore in early September, there's a conference, again, an open awareness that SARS outbreak did identify the fact that humankind is at risk for new infectious illnesses that can occur, and we need to be aware of it. I have good friends involved in the sort of bioterrorism efforts by the government, if you want. But what I'd like to discuss with them is that what we really are dealing with is nature's biological weapons program. And we really can't afford to make too many political compromises if we're going to really be upfront and able to cope with illnesses that nature can start to throw at us by recombining genes and coming up with atypical viruses, bacteria, the number of people with molds that are growing excessively in their houses. So my take on it is to recognize these illnesses and really to marshal what resources we have to help decontaminate the environment and certainly to help treat those people we can show are infected. And again, I think the responsibility now goes back to the public health labs and for people to go and say, am I virally infected? Here's a procedure. I mean, we published it on this website. This is a procedure I'd like you to follow. Tell me that I'm not infected and I'll be fine. But otherwise, I think patients can basically not assume that they're infected, but to at least demand an explanation for their illness instead of being told, quote, it's all in their head, or they're just not responding to life stresses, or basically saying that they're powerless to do anything about it, because I think people, I've seen it all too often, where a normal functioning person undergoes a kind of infectious mononucleosis type illness and infection, and then the rest of their life, they're living essentially half a life. They no longer can work, they no longer can function well socially, and it's almost unacceptable that these people not be given the benefit of a vigorous, enthusiastic public health system trying to work out what's going wrong with their brain and what's accounting for their illnesses.
Well, do you think that they come down with this infectious monobarb, Stein virus, whatever it is. And then do you think that that causes them to decompensate? They already have these viruses in place, and then these viruses begin to take off and begin to multiply and or wreaking havoc? Or do you think that the this is not infectious mono? This is an infection with these viruses. What's your impression? Yeah. How does it fit together?
No, absolutely. So the stealth adaptation process, as we said, can involve any of these large viruses, herpes viruses, whether it's an Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, herpes simplex. Just the fact that even though these viruses may be complex, containing 100 or more individual components, the immune system only targets 2 or 3 of these components in any meaningful way, and all a virus need do is to delete out 2 or 3 of 100 or so components to essentially then be unseen by the immune system, unseen effectively by the immune system, and that's this stealth adaptation process.
They really are able then to get into the body, they're able to hide, they're able to do their dirty work. You won't see the evidence of inflammation, all you'll see will be the disruption of the cells.
Absolutely, and that's why these viruses have gone undetected by the normal criterion that if you have an infection, you'd expect an inflammatory reaction. And that point is become clear once it's explained, but to the everyday pathologist, that's the blind spot. And then the second one, the public health one, who know obviously about this, is the fact that some of these viruses that have been characterized in terms of DNA sequencing have come from vaccines, in particular some from polio vaccines, and then the embarrassment of knowing that the studies that were done back in 1972 on these monkeys were never made public, and that's the sort of boogeyman, as it were, in the public health system that basically encourages people to hesitate, to hope that they'll retire before the issue becomes public. In the meantime, I think we have a lot of these diseases out there that are being called epidemics, but we have an unwillingness to truly tackle them as an infectious cause by doing the very basic viral culture studies that would show the presence of these viruses.
Well, you know, it's sort of like the space shuttle, you know. They knew there was a problem there. They knew that the foam had come off the wing, and there might be a problem, but maybe if they didn't do anything, it would simply go away. Instead of perhaps, sending up another shuttle, trying to evacuate them, well, maybe it'll be all right. And I suspect that that's what happened back in 1972. They knew the virus was there, but, nobody was dying of anything. There wasn't any manifestation of illness at that time. Maybe if we just ignore it, it won't be there. But of course, as a scientist, especially when you're responsible for human lives, you can't take a position like that and say, well, maybe it'll be all right. Because that's not, of course, what science is built upon. You have to know. And of course, you do not cover up information because you're afraid it might be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. And again, as I said in the first hour, I do believe the conscientious people at NIH, CDC, and so forth are well aware of this as a problem. The 19,000 or more people a year in hospitals with a diagnosis of encephalitis where no apparent cause can be found in the majority and so forth. These are the patients who should be looked at very vigorously for viruses, but unless the agency chiefs give the green light, unless people in Congress encourage the institutions like NIH, CDC to look into this issue, then it never will be addressed. And the only answer to that is to have a movement of people who basically say, time's up, we need to address it, we want you to do it, and that's why I'm hoping S3 support will serve that purpose.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Dr. John Martin. Welcome your calls, 1-800-5-HIV, WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And of course you remember it was a couple of years ago, after of course having used the Sabin vaccine here in America, going all the way back to about 1962 or 1963. And you remember the Sabin vaccine was the vaccine, you put a drop of this onto a sugar club, a cube, and you ate that, and then of course you got a live poliovirus. It was an attended poliovirus, and of course it wasn't didn't ordinarily give polio. Occasionally wives would go wild, and the only cases of polio we had in America were maybe 8 cases a year, where of course the virus would go back to its originally pathological condition. And of course these people would, mothers, perhaps people come in contact with somebody who had been vaccinated, and then come down with polio. But one of the great miracles of modern time was doing away with poliomyelitis here in the United States and increasingly throughout the rest of the world. But of course the problem with this was the other viruses that were in the polio vaccine, the ones that we're talking about. So here about a year and a half ago, why the CDC and the NIH came up with a recommendation. We are going to stop giving the the Salk vaccine, the live vaccine. We're going to return to the formalin-treated vaccine that was in the original Salk, and you take that by shot. And it really isn't anywhere near as good as the Sabin vaccine, but of course, it was felt that, well, we would not get 8 cases of poliomyelitis a year. Now, that sounds very, very altruistic, sounds very, very good. Sounds like, gee, we're really concerned about these 8 people are getting polio. But the question has come to my mind, knowing what I do, was that the real motivation? Or, of course, did the people working in government realize, of course, if they had only an attenuated polio vaccine, they were perhaps not actually killing the monkey viruses, the other monkey viruses, the cytomegalic viruses that we've been talking about for this first couple of hours, the first hour and a half anyway. What is your take on that thought? Was that one of the reasons they decided to change over, or was it simply to save 8 people from getting polio?
No, again, Stan, I can recall the conversation where the FDA official would ask pointedly, do I believe that the formalin inactivation with Dr. Salk vaccine would destroy these stealth viruses? And of course my answer was, I don't know, but I suspect that that was a factor in that consideration. What's interesting, having made the change at the year 2000 and slowly making the overlap a couple of years before that, again with the sad realization that that too was presented to me as a gentle way of allowing companies to use up their stocks of Sabin-type vaccines and not make the switch too abruptly. One thinks if you have a public health decision, you ought to make it and enforce it, not to make too much allowance for economic considerations of vaccine manufacturers. But what is interesting and important is, having made that switch, there was a comfort level to go back and look at the Dr. Sabin's vaccines, and our Food and Drug Administration here looked at 8 lots of vaccines released in the mid-1970. In 3 of them, they could find the DNA of monkey cytomegalovirus. So it was clearly present in 3 of the 8 vaccines. And a much larger study was done in England, published March of this year. In one manufacturer alone, 32 of 34 lots of released polio vaccine had the DNA of cytomegalovirus in it. This was interesting because they dismissed it by arguing, well, the way we're trying to culture it, we can't culture it, and therefore it's not a problem. But common sense says, gosh, if you see that, if you know of a researcher who's been culturing monkey cytomegaloviruses from more than one patient, you ought to look into it with much more thoroughness than just dismissing it by saying that in our hands we can't culture. So it's clear that there was contamination. with certainly the DNA of cytomegalovirus in many of the licensed and released lots of polio vaccine used in this country.
Now, of course, you are one of the few people who really can culture these things out, so I'm surprised they didn't send it over to you and say, is it here? Because, of course, you know, it just because you try, but if you're not an expert on it, it doesn't work, that doesn't mean it's not there at all, does it?
Now, what I've tried to put the ball back in their court, they have all the protocols published. I think it's the public health lab who should do it. Again, sadly, I know that the public health labs see these things, but again, the disconnect and not wanting to cause more of a problem. But I think the onus on culturing these self-viruses ought to be in the public health lab. They do have the methods. And I just want to mention that other little bit of fact that snuck through the English paper was that the vaccine used in Africa in the early evaluation of polio vaccine used in chimps was also contaminated with cytomegalovirus. And again, it brings up another issue which I've had with the CDC. Back in 1958, they did have serum collected on African children who had the early polio vaccines, and I had asked that they be tested to see if the vaccine was contaminated with cytomegalovirus. There was no interest in doing that study, and lo and behold, if indirectly the question has been answered by the study from England, that the vaccine used in the monkeys was contaminated with cytomegalovirus, and a very plausible argument exists now that HIV evolved in the monkeys receiving these vaccines, because we know that the cytomegaloviruses in the polio vaccines have many more receptors for HIV than does the cytomegalovirus of human or chimpanzee origin. So technically it's complex. The difficulty or the frustration that I would sense is what ought to be good science that ought to be embraced enthusiastically by people entrusted with governing our public health tends not to be. Rather than that, they shy away from this and put up bureaucratic hurdles and ignoring the issue, and that's not fair to the many thousands of people afflicted with these illnesses, which if there was a realization that there's a viral component, that could lead, hopefully, to rapid developments of effective treatment.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment for Dr. Martin, and we've covered a lot this evening, and I think you're beginning, I hope that you begin to see a certain pattern here. And of course, what we have to do is get around the bureaucratic inertia and this feeling, well, you know, we don't want to rock the boat. We certainly don't want to do anything that would be critical at all. We don't want to do anything that would alarm the American people. After all, they're suspicious enough about vaccines as it is. And vaccines have done some wonderful, wonderful things. We've done away with smallpox. We've pretty well eliminated poliomyelitis, the measles, and certainly many of these other diseases are not major problems anymore. We don't see the tetanus that we saw at one time. And of course, but if we come out and, of course, we get into this and we begin admitting these things, why, the people out there on the other side are going to have a heyday with us, so we'll just sort of ignore this. And that isn't right. I think that sometimes, well, it's sort of like when you're a doctor and you make a mistake. And you can do one of two things. You can cover up for it and you can lie, or you can come out to the patient and say, look, this is what happened, this is why it happened, I'm terribly sorry, and we're going to, of course, do everything we can to remedy the situation for you. And certainly everything should have been done to try to come up with the treatments for these people, because I believe, it, of course, as you've suggested, there are lots of things that can be done. But, of course, that is not, of course, the emphasis. I think the major emphasis has been, well, let's sort of get that dirt swept underneath the rug there, and nobody's going to see it. And of course, that there are people suffering, and I believe there are people dying because of that. Well, you know, right now, of course, Dr. Martin is hoping to get together this a general support group. It's called S3Support.com, S3Support.com. And, of course, I suppose that you would have several prongs of this. One would be that you would have, of course, the opportunity for scientific research, for running studies, for really doing these intricate studies that need to be done on one hand. And then, of course, you'd try to get people mobilized to tell others and to bring pressure on their elected representatives. Is that sort of what your thought is?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the inspiration for it was a kind invitation by a gentleman who, at the age of 27, formed the American Association of Retired Persons. So I think the concept that public opinion is a very powerful force in the country, communication like your radio show is a very powerful way of getting the message out when it is not quite mainstream, but hopefully it will become mainstream. So my hope is that if there's sufficient membership, there's certainly enough benefits, as I recognize any number of people are happy to provide their product to a group of patients for evaluation and so forth, that there would be power in having large numbers of members, benefits to them that would certainly more than compensate membership fees and so on and so forth, but it would become an effective way of communicating to the politicians that there's, in fact, justification on their part to work on behalf of the people who have these illnesses and mobilize our public health system to begin to address this as a truly major problem.
Now, one of the people back in Washington, D.C., who seems to be at least somewhat aware of some of the problems is Congressman Dan Burton. Have you had any opportunity to talk to his staff, or is there any interest on his part in exploring this?
Well, I'm sure there will be. The difficulty, as I see it, is primarily to gain access to these individuals if one doesn't have a constituency behind behind one. But he, you know, he certainly is aware, having a grandchild with autism, that something needs to be done. What surprises me is, again, most of the people pursuing autism research have been reluctant to address it as an infectious cause. Again, playing the conservative role, not being upfront and saying, well, look, we have an epidemic, epidemics linked to an infectious illness, let's see if there's not an infectious component. And I think the major concern in that regard is still the majority of people identifying with studies on autism and so forth are not really experts in the area of infectious disease and haven't taken into account or don't really appreciate yet the concept of these stealth-adapted viruses.
Well, now, of course, one of the stories we hear very often from parents, and I've heard this from many parents, you know, my child is doing fine. They went in, they had their immunization shot, and then, of course, they began, of course, to regress from that point of view. Well, now, more recently, it's been pointed out that there is a fairly substantial amount of mercury that's been in those shots, and, of course, way out of proportion. I mean, 35 or 50 times the amount that the EPA has said, and, of course, you're not simply giving it by mouth, you're giving it right into the bloodstream. Could the mercury toxin in any way activate an underlying stealth virus infection, in your estimation?
Yeah. This is very interesting, Stan. I mean, again, I try to understand from interacting with these people the different motivations. And one motivation is, let us run with this, John. It's not correct, but we'll at least make some headway. My take on it, now that we now know about these alternate cellular energy pigments, it's the material that the mercury ties into, these ACE pigments, that's the relevant component more than the mercury itself. I think the idea of focusing on a toxin, whether it's mercury or even pesticides and so on and so forth, is missing the urgency of focusing on this illness as an infectious disease. And so in some ways, I do see the lawsuits developing and this and that, but it would be a shame if that was a compromise that would detract the attention, eventually result in a conclusion that mercury is not the factor causing the illness. It's known for the majority of autistic children that that if you look at the cord blood at birth, there are abnormalities present, that the illness, in fact, predates the vaccine. Certainly, activating the immune response with a vaccine, even adding a toxin such as mercury, could aggravate an underlying viral illness. I think it's a shame to be putting so much focus on mercury itself as the cause when the data don't really support it, but more importantly, it takes the focus again away from an epidemic linked to an infectious process.
Well, could mercury, though, be a cofactor? In other words, is there any way that mercury could so damage the cell that it would be more susceptible? And or you mentioned that it would combine with these pigments that you've been working with. In other words, could this be a precipitating effect or, in other words, lighting up the infection that's already there?
Oh, absolutely. And again, the nice thing about having the cultures is that we can take the cultures, assess how much damage is occurring, and then add varying factors to it, as you've done with pesticides and so forth. And if a cell is having to cope with a virus, it's probably unable to deal effectively with any type of toxin, whether it's mercury or other heavy metals and so forth. Again, though, that is a difference between a cofactor, and that can be important, but not if it detracts one away from an underlying infectious cause. So I think, again, so much research is needed to be done. My own personal hope is that science should speak for itself, good science should be heard, and the people who control our government science agencies, primarily congressmen, would be open to listen to different viewpoints. The viewpoint that has not been allowed to be heard with regard to the autism epidemic is the possibility that it's an infectious process. And I can speak from firsthand, it comes back, don't go there, John, because if you do, you might impair educational opportunities. You're going to open up the whole issue of how do you prevent infections from occurring. And I think that that kind of consideration is typical of the kind of conservative approach that doesn't really address the underlying problem and therefore doesn't lead to a rapid resolution of the problem.
Well, of course, science is the search for the truth. I mean, it's science is not political. It's not Republican or Democrat, right or left, conservative or liberal. Science is the search for the truth. And that is really what it's all about. That's the only way you're going to have any advancement at all. That's the only way we're going to influence lives or even save lives in this struggle that's going on today.
Well, I so totally agree. And again, for the audience out there, I'm sure it can resonate with some members of your listening audience. Autism will occur, but it will occur in a family where other members are afflicted with other brain-related or brain-damaging illnesses. And what's being called autism now is really quite different from what used to be autism in the classical sense. And I'm sure it will be best understood as a viral-induced damage to the cells, and hopefully there will be these alternate cellular energy pigments that can be identified, and they can be providing a useful target for effective therapies.
And of course, as you pointed out earlier, the mother, if she has the virus, can pass it on to through the fetal blood to the child, and of course that child then of course is susceptible because of the latent infection that's already there to the progression of disease. Now, you've actually tested had people tested who were giving blood. Wasn't that group of college students that were tested? What's the incidence of this disease in college students and other studies where you're looking for these monkey viruses?
Yeah, at least 10% of students at a local university here who, with informed consent and so forth, were giving blood to go into the blood supply, but also were willing to provide a sample of blood for viral culture testing. 10% of those cultures showed the presence of a viral infection. That is disturbing. We don't know whether that 10% had symptoms or not, whether they were struggling with their classes, having a lot of coffee, or whether they had absolutely no symptoms. but I suspect that there is at least a considerable number of people out there who are infected with these viruses, and that's in that group. The same way we did a double-blind study on autistic children, and again, the vast majority were infected, and certainly in contrast to the control group, and that was done by independent investigators. So there's no question that these viruses are out there. Having a virus by itself doesn't equate to any particular set of symptoms. But if you have the symptoms, the first thing to exclude is, or to determine, if one is virally infected, and then that naturally leads to the necessary clinical testing if we suppress the virus, or if we try to compensate for the damage being done by the virus, will we bring about clinical improvements?
Well, now, I think that this is a study that I wasn't well aware of, that they've actually tested autistic children and non-autistic children, and what sort of percentage of the autistic children would be infected? What sort of percentage of the non-autistic children would be infected?
Yeah, I'm just recalling now, and again, when I said independent, it's a study done by a microbiologist, PhD, and a clinical laboratory scientist, and there was something like 20 autistic children, I think 17 gave positive results, and on the control group, probably of also 20, I'm just guessing now, somewhere 3-4 or so. But it was a nice clean study that was done, and again, I was anticipating the Autism Society or support groups would pick up on that, but again, the argument is, no, for political reasons, let's back off. Let's call it an epidemic, but let's not address it as a...
an infectious epidemic. Those are exciting figures. Now, they were actually looking for these monkeys, cytomegalic virus?
Well, just a broad definition of any agent that's producing this cell damage typical of the stealth-adapted viruses.
All right, so they were actually looking for this type of a virus.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it was a study done. I mean, again, in my mind, the existence of these viruses is unequivocal. It's based now on sequence data and so forth. The actual performance of it, of the assays, I think, is now the responsibility of the public health labs to run these cultures. And again, just basically pull the curtain on the issue and open it up to say, if we have an epidemic, first thing we have to exclude is the presence of an infectious component. Knowing that vaccines were contaminated, certainly with foreign DNA or viral DNA, it behooves our public health system to look at this. And so the question is, how will that transformation occur? From my point of view as a lone scientist, trying to say please do it doesn't carry much weight, certainly carries no weight in Washington. If there's a movement following a grassroots effort, people are willing to express the same concern and expectation that these viruses be looked for in these clinical conditions, then it will have some impact. Hopefully that's the way politicians will work. If there's enough public interest and public opinion to do that, then the system will respond. And that's the expectation behind S3 support. But it will require participation by members of your audience and other people around the country to carry sufficient weight and conviction to have a political change in Washington.
Well, I certainly applaud your effort, and I certainly hope that it will have that impact, because I think it's an issue that really needs to be explored. In fact, I think that predominance, those figures that you gave them, 17 of the infants, 17 of the children with autism were positive, only 3% of non-autistic children were positive. And that would suggest, that certainly There's a definite causal relationship. And then, of course, the three that had the virus, but they perhaps didn't have the insult, whether it be whatever it was that would actually provoke this whole thing and set off the infection and have it then begin consuming the tissues of the brain. This is a rather frightening thing. Has anybody actually looked at the brains of autistic children post-mortem or biopsies or any or MRIs, anything of that sort available?
Yeah, and again, there's evidence of brain damage. Again, these are brain damaging illnesses. There's no question about that. They haven't been looked, I mean, we haven't looked at it for these subtle changes, but we have looked at brain biopsies from children who've had portions of the brain removed from epilepsy and so forth, and there is this hallmark of non-inflammatory change, but the presence of these foamy, vacuolated cells. And again, one more task I have is to get to the neuropathologist looking at this tissue and work with them to try to identify with them these various issues. I did not go to Atlanta for just canceled the trip, but before going, my offer was to sit down with the pathologist at CDC and go through the brain biopsies that they're receiving from these undiagnosed encephalitis cases around the country and see if we can't identify together these changes so as to increase that level of confidence amongst people that you can have viral infection without an inflammatory reaction. And there's no question in my mind we have that because of the animal studies that we've done and because of the patients whom we've followed with evidence of viral infection, and the whole sort of the clinical data are very compelling, and it yet requires an opportunity to express it, and that's going to require our public health officials being willing to consider an infectious component in these illnesses. And I guess I'm just racing for time, but just I want to make this last point. I think with all of these illnesses, autism is a good example, it's not that the infection excludes a genetic component. That's clearly present. Boys get it more than girls or some other genetic factors. But it's infection plus genetics plus environmental plus autoimmune that make these illnesses quite complicated. But the infectious component is far and away the most important to pursue, because that's the one that we can get a better handle on in terms of treatment and certainly in terms of prevention of spread of infection.
Well, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us again. This is a guest has been Dr. John Martin. And, of course, his website is S3 Support. And we hope many of you will go there, look at it, and give a serious consideration to joining in this epic struggle to determine if we can actually bring pressure to bear so that the government and the public health agencies will begin, of course, addressing this very, very real problem that is affecting increasing numbers of people all across America, certainly every day. God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, this has been Dr. John Martin, and I certainly hope that you've enjoyed the program with him. And this is the time, of course, we ask you, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because, of course, if our America does not return to God, why, of course, God will never again bless this nation. Lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time when we'll be with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.